Korean War, Incheon. General Douglas MacArthur launches one of the boldest strikes in military history.
All of his subordinates said it couldn't be done. He intuitively knew that the Incheon landing would work and would change the course of the war.
It was absolutely brilliant.
One of the greatest military feats in history.
Is that if it failed, it would be god-awful.
He is 70 years old, the American ruler of Japan, when suddenly called back to war as commander of the world's first United Nations force.
The bugle, the soldier awakes and rallies to the colors. In June 1950, General Douglas MacArthur hears it once more. This time the bugle cries, a telephone ring. War in Korea. He remembers that moment. I had an uncanny feeling of nightmare. It had been 9 years before, on a Sunday morning at the same hour, that a telephone call with the same note of urgency had awakened me in the penthouse atop the Manila Hotel. It was the same fell note of the war cry that was again ringing in my ears. It couldn't be, I told myself. Not again. How, I asked myself, could the United States have allowed such a deplorable situation to develop?
June 25, 1950. 90,000 North Korean troops, Soviet equipped, lunge across the 38th parallel. Washington and its ally, South Korea, are unprepared. The army breaks and flees. The U.S. sees the invasion as evidence of a global communist threat. For once, Washington and MacArthur agree.
The communist threat is a global one. Its successful advance in one sector threatens the destruction of every other sector. You cannot appease or otherwise surrender to communism in Asia without simultaneously undermining our efforts to halt its advance in Europe.
Korea, just a small remote peninsula divided at the 38th parallel. The two capitals, Seoul and Pyongyang, become confronting camps in the Cold War. In the north, the Soviets install Kim Il-sung, a Moscow-trained major. In the south, after U.S.-supported elections, Syngman Rhee becomes president. For Rhee's inauguration, the U.S. sends MacArthur and his wife, Jean. The general's visit is mainly ceremonial. But MacArthur tells Rhee he will defend South Korea as he would California. It is mere rhetoric, a chance to voice his anti-communism. Both the Americans and Russians seek to control, not unleash their puppets. MacArthur's biographer, William Manchester.
Korea was regarded as insignificant and beyond the defense perimeter of the United States. This had been stated by Dean Acheson, who was our Secretary of State, and also by Douglas MacArthur. It was a tragic miscalculation on the part of the communists. They believed, and with some justification, that the Americans would not contest a conquest of South Korea by North Korea.
Korea's priority in the Cold War changes in 1949 as Mao Zedong conquers all of mainland China. President Truman now fears Sino-Soviet expansionism. He approves a secret policy recommendation to resist communist encroachment anywhere. Unaware of the U.S. combat commitment, North Korea prepares to invade the South, and MacArthur, suddenly called to arms, is shocked. He argues too late that Korea is not the place to take a stand.
Thus, step by step, the United States went to war against communism in Asia. I could not help being amazed at the manner in which this great decision was being made. With no submission to Congress, whose duty it is to declare war, and without even consulting the field commander involved, the members of the executive branch of the government agreed to enter the Korean War. All the risks inherent in this decision, including the possibility of Chinese and Russian involvement, applied then just as much as they applied later.
Truman wins the support of the United Nations Security Council for a UN police action. For the first time, the world body will seek to impose its law. British political analyst Keith Kyle.
The feeling in Britain when North Korea invaded South Korea was that this was the test of the United Nations. All through the war, people had spoken of how the League of Nations had lacked teeth. And that the thing above all, which the successor organization had to have, was teeth. In fact, of course, in the Security Council of the United Nations, the permanent members had a veto. And it was only because Russia was sulking in her tent, boycotting the meetings of the Security Council, that it was possible for the United Nations to act with such great speed in the case of Korea.
13 member countries promised troops, and there's no doubt who must lead them. MacArthur, lifetime defender of the Stars and Stripes, is given the blue UN flag as commander of the ill-prepared Allies. In the first week of war, the South Korean army is in mass retreat, having abandoned the capital, Seoul. The first American troops sent in are sufficient only to guard U.S. air bases. The U.N. war and the new U.S. doctrine of resistance already seem a lost cause. Five days after the invasion, MacArthur flies to Korea to see how he can avert defeat.
MacArthur went into South Korea when the situation was still chaotic and refugees were pouring south. And he was standing on a little hilltop just staring down at this flood of refugees, including demoralized South Korean soldiers. And it was then, he later said, that he conceived of the Incheon landing, far behind the enemy lines.
In that brief interval on that blood-soaked hill, I formulated my plans. They were desperate plans indeed, but I could see no other way unless to accept a defeat which would include not only Korea, but all of continental Asia. Completely outnumbered, I would rely upon strategic maneuver to overcome the great odds against me.
MacArthur doesn't immediately reveal his plan to save Korea. He builds towards it. At first, he requests only 20,000 men. He demands another 50,000 men, but Washington hesitates. It means withdrawing troops from Europe. The Europe First policy has enraged MacArthur ever since Pearl Harbor. Once more, he complains of having to fight with his hands tied. From the start, MacArthur and Truman differ, and it sets them on a collision course. Truman wants a limited war to prove communism can be contained. MacArthur regards war as an evil to be stamped out only through the total defeat of the aggressors. His operations chief in Korea, Major General Edwin Wright.
He always had only one thing in mind. He never conceived. He had no place in his mind for anything except winning. This is absolutely foreign to him to think of anything else. So his approach was always that. His approach was always the offense, never any defense of any kind.
The American tradition has always been that once our troops are committed to battle, the full power and means of the nation would be mobilized and dedicated to fight for victory rather than stalemate or compromise. Not for the wildest stretch of imagination did I dream that this tradition might be broken.
MacArthur's forces, being pushed toward the sea, try conventional retreat, blowing bridges. To improve morale, MacArthur introduces a buddy system. Each American fights beside a Korean. Surprised by the increased resistance, the North Koreans pause long enough for MacArthur to form a defensive perimeter. British soldiers arrive, the vanguard of 40,000 Commonwealth troops, to be followed by French, Turks, Dutch, and Filipinos. They land at Busan, the last port in South Korea. The North Koreans have overrun the rest of the country, except a small corner in the southeast, the Busan perimeter. If it is lost, Busan could become another Dunkirk. Marine Colonel Taplet.
It was bad. The whole perimeter was beginning to cave in, and as I said, when we landed at Busan, the first information we had was that the North Koreans are only about 25 miles from Busan, and the natives that we could see on the dock work, and you could see that they were worried. They had this look of, you know, despair, fear in their eyes, and we knew that we were going to be thrown into a buzzsaw.
For the men at the front, the wider purpose of the war, be it Truman's police action or MacArthur's anti-Red crusade, has ceased to matter. They're fighting now for survival. MacArthur is diverted from the real crisis to a potential one. He's ordered to Formosa to restrain Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang is offered to send 35,000 of his Chinese nationalist troops to Korea. Washington firmly declines, but worries that Chiang might still widen the war by sending his troops into China. MacArthur is told to warn Chiang that the U.S. will block any attempt to invade the mainland.
MacArthur's visit to Formosa was made on instructions from Washington. It was not his decision to go to Formosa, which became controversial. It was the way the thing was handled. And he gave the impression that Chiang Kai-shek was an ally and that they were in this together. And Chiang, of course, was a very controversial figure himself.
The sudden huddle between the general and the generalissimo is viewed suspiciously around the world. Two old warlords getting together to plot World War III. Chiang issues a communique implying that MacArthur backs the invasion of China. Washington is frantic.
This was when Truman began worrying about MacArthur's good judgment and about his politics.
To my astonishment, the visit to Formosa and my meeting with Chiang Kai-shek was greeted by a furor. My habitual critics, including those within the United Nations, who advocated appeasement of the Soviet Union and Red China, naturally set in with their cudgels. But I was somewhat startled to find myself attacked by certain groups within the United States itself.
MacArthur, as statesman, is a disaster in Washington's eyes. But MacArthur, the general, is still supreme. He now reveals his bold plan for winning the war, a landing at Incheon, far behind enemy lines. Incheon, a small seaport on Korea's northwest coast. Although the closest harbor to occupied Seoul, Incheon is a hazardous target, but it has tactical advantages. Admiral Arleigh Burke.
So he was quite correct in the desirability of having an amphibious attack in Incheon. And Incheon was the only place on the coast where an amphibious landing could really be made, where it was effective and where we could quickly cut the enemy's supply lines.
If you subjected the Incheon landing to a more logical analysis, you could think of all sorts of reasons why it would fail. from the hydrographic conditions to the state of our amphibious shipping to the lack of time for planning to the rather disorganized way that forces have been gathered. Many good reasons for Inshan to fail. But MacArthur's intuition told him that it would succeed.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff had agreed to MacArthur planning an amphibious operation. But at that time, they didn't know where it was. And when they found out it was at Inshan, there was a great deal of concern back in Washington because right away they could see the difficulties, you know, the high tide, the mud flats, and all this sort of thing. So General Collins, the Army Chief of Staff, and Admiral Sherman, Chief of Naval Operations, came over to Tokyo to talk to MacArthur and see if this really was something that they could go along with. Because up to this time, there had not been any agreement that we could do it.
For the first time in many years, the Lord of Japan and commander of an international army is called upon to defend his planning. MacArthur's resentment of Washington has never been deeper.
I could almost hear my father's voice telling me, as he had many years ago, "Doug, councils of war breed timidity and defeatism."
There were a few questions that were asked by Admiral Sherman and General Collins, and then General MacArthur took over. And for 40 minutes, without a note of any kind, he probably gave one of the finest talks that anybody ever listened to. And at the end of it, it would have been impossible for anybody not to agree with him. Although, while they didn't know it was too late to stop it even then.
September 15, 1950. MacArthur, aboard his command ship Mount McKinley, watches his fleet of 260 ships move toward Inchon. It's a nerve-wracking passage through the sea channels. Among the naval commanders, the man who got him out of the Philippines, Admiral Buckley.
Here I commanded a destroyer division that time. Went up that channel in the middle of the night there without lights. A very difficult piece of navigation, a very threatening one here since I've never been in those waters. But we did it.
You knew that the day was going to come and that you were going to get into the boats and go.
I think we arrived there sometime around midnight, and we didn't boat until about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. So we were sitting there like sitting ducks, and it was sort of weird to come topside in the ship and look over and see the silhouette of Romido Island and the Inchon Harbor. And it was eerie from the standpoint that it was so quiet.
Within 5 hours, 40,000 men would act boldly in the hope that 100,000 others manning the thin defense lines in South Korea would not die. I alone was responsible for tomorrow, and if I failed, the dreadful results would rest on Judgment Day against my soul.
Veteran Marine Commander, Brigadier General Edwin Simmons.
My chief recollection of the Inchon landing was the smoke and the drizzle and the darkness as we approached the beach. And as the waterfront in the city had been bombed and shelled almost incessantly for the last several days, there were fires and the smoke added to the mist and the slight drizzle sort of cast a grayish green pall over the whole landing area.
The landing proves dramatic in a way no one expected. Inchon is taken in just a few hours. MacArthur's losses, 500 dead, are relatively light. His troops later trapped 50,000 North Koreans. He has staked his reputation at Inchon. Now he cannot control his relief. He throws up. But he was right.
Yet our goddamn Joint Chiefs of Staff, they didn't quite approve of the whole thing at the beginning here. They thought it was too bold a move. Again, you're coming right back to the genius of MacArthur. He could see those things. He knew where to put the thrust, where to make the great stroke and terminate the war. Great. No question about it.
Whenever I perform a mission and think I have done it well, I feel I can face up squarely to my dad and say, Governor, what about it?
It's 5 days before MacArthur can go ashore. He shows his customary disregard for danger and spends several hours at the front with his men, at times shot at by snipers. A photographer there, Carl Midens.
He said during the Incheon landing that this was a great moment in history, and he was doing two things in that Incheon landing. He was winning the war in Korea up to that point, and he was creating great military history. He was aware of it every moment that he was there.
And so I saw General MacArthur stride up to the top of the hill to meet Colonel Lewis Burwell Puller, better known as Chesty Puller, who was then commanding the 1st Marine Regiment. And both of these persons were consummate actors, and they were both playing the role to the hilt. MacArthur was in full costume, the crushed hat, the sunglasses, the leather jacket, the faded but carefully pressed khaki trousers. And you know, the curious thing is that he, General MacArthur, so dominated that scene, although there were many other notables and dignitaries in the party. The only person of whom I have a definite impression, other than Colonel Puller, is General MacArthur. He completely dominated the scene.
Through his classic move at Incheon, MacArthur frees all of South Korea in 15 days. His besieged force at Busan breaks out and joins up with the Incheon invaders. Seoul, the capital, is retaken in 9 days. MacArthur has freed and secured the South, or so it seems. He stages a victory parade in Seoul.
The operation for the re-entry of President Rhee was somewhat more complicated and somewhat more detailed than the Incheon landing, and much more carefully rehearsed. We had fought for the city and we had won it. And then 2 days later, General MacArthur did arrive, landing at Kimpo Airfield, and a procession of limousines and other vehicles had been assembled. And part of it was that we Americans were to stay out of sight. We were to provide a cordon of protection and security along the march route, but we were not to be too visible. Chiefly visible would be the cheering Koreans welcoming their president home.
MacArthur has become accustomed to the personal grandeur of restoring heads of state in the Philippines, in Japan, now in South Korea. He enters the legislative chamber with Syngman Rhee, arm in arm, recites the Lord's Prayer, then hands over the reins of the Republic to the old dictator.
President Rhee seemed deeply moved by it all. He rose and clasped my hand. We admire you, he said, with tears flowing down his cheeks. We love you as the savior of our race.
But it isn't over. MacArthur is determined that the North must be defeated and Korea reunited. He wants total victory. This has always been his code. It will now be his downfall.
And when the ceremony was over, the people of Seoul lined the streets and clapped and waved their little paper flags. I returned to Tokyo.
En svensk nyhetsutsändning den 6 februari 1952 lät så här.
Förhandlingsdelegaterna i Panmunjom samlades idag för första gången på 2 månader till plenarsammanträde för att förbereda diskussionerna om den sista frågan på dagordningen. Den nordkoreanske delegaten general Nam Il föreslog att en politisk konferens mellan ledande personligheter ska ordnas inom 3 månader efter det att ett stilleståndsavtal har undertecknats. Enligt Nam Il borde regeringarna i den folkdemokratiska republiken Korea och folkrepubliken Kina å ena sidan och FN-ländernas regeringar å den andra utse vardera 5 representanter som ska hålla en politisk konferens för att genom förhandlingar bestämma om de utländska truppernas avlägsnande från Korea, en fredlig lösning av Koreafrågan samt andra frågor som hör ihop med freden i Korea. General Nam Il talade idag om folkrepubliken Kina snarare än om de kinesiska frivilliga. Sydkorea nämndes överhuvudtaget inte som representant för FN-sidan. Krigsfångutskottet enades efter en överläggning i 3/4 om att Röda Kors-delegater från båda sidor ska få besöka krigsfångeläger och hjälpa till med att sända hem fångarna. Man enades vidare preliminärt om att utväxlingen av fångar ska ske också på några andra orter än Panmunjom. Kommunisterna gick däremot inte med på att neutrala representanter ska få besöka fångarna för att ta reda på om dessa vill bli hemsända eller inte. För internationernas stilleståndsförhandlare saknar nationell värdighet och stolthet, och deras diskussioner medan hundratals av deras soldater dödas är rent nonsens, sa Sydkoreas president Syngman Rhee i en presskonferens igår. Han framhöll att han hellre skulle låta sydkoreanska självmordsförband slåss med kommunisterna än acceptera ett stilleståndsavtal enligt vilket Korea förblir delat i 2 stater.
Den 31 mars 1997. Här är några inslag från Discovery TVs återblick på slutfaserna i Koreakriget.
Last 4 months after North Korea had stormed into the south, United Nations forces were taking the war across the 38th parallel into North Korea. Back in Washington, Truman was coming under increasing fire from the right for his supposed softness on communism. Feeling that some of MacArthur's popularity would rub off on him, he invited the general to what was supposed to be a private meeting on Wake Island in the middle of the Pacific. When Truman stepped down to the tarmac to be greeted by his field commander, MacArthur did not salute. He shook hands as an equal. MacArthur had immediately understood Truman's real reason for the meeting. This was just a photo opportunity for a beleaguered president. Their smiles had been for the press only. In truth, they could hardly bear to talk to each other. For more than an hour, MacArthur went over his battle plans for the taking of North Korea. Finally, Truman had only one question. Would the Chinese invade? MacArthur assured him that the threat had passed. He was furious at the waste of his time. From now on, he'd run the war his own way. MacArthur's next target was Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. From his plane, he watched his men parachute behind enemy lines. He took Pyongyang with ease, and it was now that he determined to proceed right up to the Chinese border with all the forces at his command, in direct defiance of President Truman's orders. He was tired of Washington's caution. Nobody would dare challenge him. United Nations forces were now approaching the very frontiers of the vast Communist Republic of China. As they surged northwards, they took more and more prisoners. But as Korea's bitter winter drew on, behind the tattered North Koreans, there began to appear a different type of enemy. Dressed in quilted weatherproof uniforms, these soldiers were disciplined fighters. It was beginning to look as though Truman's fears would be justified. The Chinese were indeed becoming involved. On November the 28th, 1950, a massive human killing machine swarmed out of North Korean mountains. The Chinese had slipped a quarter of a million well-trained men over the border and seemed not to care how many died. For the United Nations forces, retreat was the only option. But now, they had the Korean winter to contend with. Thousands lost their lives to the enemy, but unprepared for the howling winds and snow and in temperatures around 25 degrees below zero, many simply died of cold. All the territory that MacArthur had won since the Incheon landing was lost. By the 15th of December, the 8th Army had been pushed back across the 38th parallel. MacArthur was humiliated. He had underestimated the enemy's size and their intentions. His reputation was in ruins, and he wanted revenge. In his rage, he turned to the ultimate weapon. He demanded that he be allowed to use the atomic bomb. By December the 24th, he had finalized and submitted his plans. He needed 26 atomic bombs. He would target sites in North Korea and Manchuria, and cities as far away as Peking and Lusan in China, Vladivostok in the Soviet Union, and many others. They would all be annihilated. MacArthur waited for a response. His plans were being considered. Meanwhile, the war dead were now arriving home. The American people were sick of the war. Pressure to use nuclear weapons was becoming irresistible. At that moment, it seemed that President Truman was seriously considering using the atom bomb. He ordered dummy nuclear runs over North Korea. In the winter of 1950, the world teetered on the edge of nuclear war. The United States was no longer the only atomic power. Since 1949, the Soviet Union under Stalin had been conducting its own nuclear tests. Prime Minister Attlee of Great Britain flew to Washington to persuade the president that nuclear war could mean the end of civilization. But suddenly, the situation on the battlefield changed. Low on supplies and with staggering losses, the Chinese came to a halt in mid-January. Immediately, the United Nations went back on the offensive. The longest retreat in American history had ended. At the same time, the UN was at last winning the war in the skies. For the first time in history, jet fighters engaged in deadly combat. Stunned by the deadly Russian-built MiG-15, the US Air Force had hastened the deployment of its newly developed Sabre fighter. It proved to be more than a match for the MiG. As MacArthur toured the front line, the message came. Truman was hoping to negotiate a ceasefire. There would be no all-out war with Red China. Nuclear weapons would not be deployed. MacArthur's plans had been rejected by the administration. MacArthur continued to goad the administration with public threats to bring the Chinese to heel. They must surrender or face the consequences. The stage was set for the final showdown with Truman. The big general in the Far East had gone too far. He had to go. Truman's advisors and chiefs of staff were all in agreement. He would be told officially on April the 11th. In fact, MacArthur learned of his dismissal from a radio broadcast heard by his aide. Millions knew before he did.
It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
In firing MacArthur, Truman had finally said no to all-out war with China. But to most American people, MacArthur was the hero. In Congress, he made the speech of a lifetime, comparing himself to the old soldier of the Barrack Room Ballad.
And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. an old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
The Korean War dragged on for another 2 years. During that time, the United Nations casualties rose to 140,000, including 33,000 American dead. 1.5 million communist soldiers lost their lives. There was no victory for either side. The country was devastated, but when the armistice was signed on July the 23rd, 1953, the truce line had hardly moved from the 38th parallel. Japan was the only winner. Its economy fueled by the United Nations war effort, it was now firmly on course to becoming one of the greatest economic powers of the century. The Korean War had seen the end of two great men. 6 months before the ceasefire, President Truman finally stood down. And yet, as he made his farewell speech from the Oval Office, he was still able to say that the decision to go into Korea was the most important of his time in office. Korea had been the turning point in the Cold War. For the first time, free nations had met the test.
We have no regret. We feel we have done our best in the public service. I hope and believe we have contributed to the welfare of the nation and to the peace of the world. And now the time has come for me to say good night and God bless you.
The world also understood for the first time that in the nuclear age, all-out war would bring total destruction. And so the atomic bomb became the great deterrent. After Korea, nuclear weapons brought an uneasy peace between the superpowers. The alternative was too horrific to contemplate.